Well, my pal Magnus Hastick has been writing about and managing investments for 40 years. He says he's never seen anything like Tony Bell. Tony Bell is with us today. We will find out what his incredible achievement is. Magnus describes it like winning the Grand Slam in golf and tennis. In other words, the four majors on both of those sports. Tony Bell is with us today. He is the Chief Investment Officer at ThinkCell, a very deep-thinking human being, and you will find out how he has managed to top a very large section of the performance tables for 1, 3, 5, 7, and 10 years. He's number one in all of those, and Magnus says that's just about impossible. Well, Tony, I was delighted to see the structure of your portfolios, and we were going to go into those in some details because you have similar holdings. The first South African asset manager who's got similar holdings to what we have in the BizNews portfolio, global portfolio. So that's quite cool. And you can give us your thoughts on that. But my goodness, this performance of yours hasn't just happened overnight. You've had a long, long history. Looking back through your CV, I don't know how many South Africans remember Southern Life, but you were very involved there with Neil Chapman in his day, I presume.
Yep, and the key people in that business were Jan Carlitz, who headed it up, and then subsequently a great mentor of mine, Shams Pathak, and John Scott and Paul Beachy hit. So those memories were very formative, Alex, very.
Those are top names and top guys who went on to do extraordinary achievements themselves, but then I see you were at Seyfried's Asset Management. Was that with Leon Kampfer and the whole pre-coronation group?
No, we in fact, in 1994, we were part of the relief team. Leon and Tony Gibson and Tace and all the guys had left. And I think if I recall correctly, there were a couple of people left in the business. And we decided it was quite an exciting opportunity. We wanted to go in and, in a sense, rescue Seyfried's. And a couple of people got together, and we ended up having quite an incredible team. If you think of the names that put Seyfried's back together, we had Guy Wolford, myself, Yannick Kaper, ex-Ivor Jones Roy. Then you had Tim Alsop, who went on to form ABAX, or what was called Polaris, Anthony Sedgwick, Neil Brown, Marius van Rooyen, Debbie Tredue, Pete Major. It really was quite a team. And, you know, without getting into the politics of it, I suspect if Netcore had left Seyfried's to its own, it would have been well in excess of a couple of 100 billion today.
Yeah, it would have been with that team, Alan Gray and Coronation, well, would have been left trailing in your dust. But let's talk about Tony Bell and your journey in the most recent past to get number one, to be number one on all of those determinants, year, 1, 3, 5, 7. And 10 years is, as Magnus says, it's completely extraordinary. It does also say that you've been thinking very differently to your peers.
How did that happen? Alex, it's not a terribly exciting story, but I think it is quite an interesting story. I did my master's thesis many, many, many years ago at the University of Stellenbosch on the price formation process. And that's an extremely dull topic for most people. But what I started to work out after having analyzed companies like Sasol and, you know, many other big companies in my earlier years at Southern Life and Seyfried's was that forecasting was really difficult. And I had spent a lot of time working with very learned folk in the industry that I had spent a lot of time just trying to convince the audience that forecasting wasn't the way to go. And it kind of got me thinking about how you think about shares. Now, for most of our formal training, we are taught that the market is inefficient, that the market presents a value opportunity. And if you work really hard and you're good enough and you run your valuation models, you can find that opportunity and you can capture it and you can bring it into a portfolio and you can call it alpha, because the stock that you've magically found that is undervalued is now in the portfolio and you have unlocked that value. And I realized that the whole thing was just nonsense. Markets are highly efficient. And what really changed my thinking was a paper in 2006 by Gleason and Lee. And they studied 136,000 forecasts, both on the sell side and the buy side. And here was the crunch. For one to get any information value from your forecast, you had to be in the top 2% accuracy of all forecasts. That means you were going to have a 98% chance of being wrong. Now, if you liken it to golf, I used to be an avid golfer, but I also realized I was a very average golfer. And if I took the driver out the bag, given my size, I could give the ball some distance, but the trajectory was always very variable. So I often visited fairways that I didn't intend to go and visit to get my ball back from the fairway. And I started to think about this in relation to the equity market. And I said, well, if the most important thing that one needs to do is to be able to forecast those earnings, but you've got a 98% chance that you're going to be wrong. And remember, we're covering over 700 companies globally. How do you do it? And I started to think about inference. I'd worked for a very long time with Rowan William Short. He's an exceptionally bright guy. And Rowan is also a very deep thinker. And he uses inference extensively in the bond market. And I was sitting in one of his presentations one day, and I thought to myself, what if I try to use inference in the equity market? And then, not to make it too long a story, I thought to myself, what if I changed my whole way of thinking? Let's assume that Tony cannot forecast. That's a given. Let's assume it doesn't matter what valuation model that I run, I'm not going to come to any answer that's not already known to the market. And let's assume that there's no information that exists today at this moment that you or I could use to better assess the prospects for Nvidia, Apple, Eli Lilly, whichever stock you pick. We just simply cannot distill that information into a valuation which would say the price that we get is different from the price that's in the market. So I reverse engineered the whole thing. I took the price and I asked myself, what is the market telling me about the company? And I worked out a way some time ago to separate, that might sound very simple, good companies from bad companies, value from price. So the pathways that we follow are very simple. If the price of a share is going up, it does not mean that it is becoming more expensive. It simply means that the market is discounting a higher implied earnings growth rate. Conversely, if the share price is falling, it does not mean that the stock is becoming cheaper. I think this narrative around cheap and expensive has become so overplayed. These are cheap stocks and these are expensive stocks. In ThinkSell's sort of diction, you will never hear us refer to cheap or expensive stocks because we don't know how to find them. What we do know how to find is stocks where the price is going up, where the earnings growth vector is improving, and I'll explain that. And then we studiously avoid stocks where the price is going down, because we're not looking for value. We're not looking for stocks that we believe to be cheap. We just see them as poor investments because their share price is going down. At what point in the last year was Pfizer a good investment? At no point. At what point in the last year was Eli Lilly a good investment? Most points. the distinction between having Pfizer and Eli Lilly in your portfolio is significant. So if I summarize it all, we worked out a way to use the price of a share to infer the earnings forecast rate. And so we used the price to proxy what we were trying to do in our earnings forecast models. And what we found, and this is where it gets really interesting in complex theory, what we found in summary was when you get into a very complex system like the market, the aggregate, the market, is always better than the individual or the computer. Some folk might argue, well, DeepSeek will do this better. Maybe it will. We've written the algos. We know how they work. But we still think that the market, there's something magical in the market where when you have lots of participants actively looking for price discovery outside of an event where you have a liquidity or volatility-driven event that dislocates price from value. You see that in the 2008 global financial crisis, you know, 92, 94, 98, 01, 07, and recently 2020. Those were all quite systemic drawdowns, big drawdown risk events where price does dislocate from value. That is a separate mechanism within the market, but ordinarily you have two simple big vectors, up or down. People sort of get confused when they hear me speak because they say, it can't be that simple. It is that simple. If price is going up, you've got to work out why the price is going up. And then you've got to try and understand the share market as a picture. The market paints a picture of a stock for you yesterday. The market paints a picture of the stock for you today. What's the difference? Understand what the price formation is telling you about the market's assessment of what the company is likely to produce in the future. So we just think of it like a series of earnings growth rates. If the market is going up and it's very stable, Johnson & Johnson, Unilever, Procter & Gamble, whatever, you would be very surprised to find big up or big down movements in the share price. If you find something like Eli Lilly, where it's cruising along and suddenly it starts to go a lot steeper, then we get interested because we say, what's happening in this company that might be accelerating earnings growth? And we spend a lot of time unpacking that. And we reverse engineer the implied growth rate, really understanding the fundamentals of the company. We're not a quant house, we're fundamental. We want to unpack where that earnings growth rate is coming from. And we do that with looking at the industry, the company, its products, everything that we're all trained to do as fundamental analysts. But what the distinct difference is, Alex, is we do not impose our assessment of growth on a company. We work out what the market is telling us. So I can play an easy game with you. Let's pick Woolworths. And I said to you, Alex, Woolworths is going to grow 8 to 12% in the next 3 years. You're going to say, Tony, I feel comfortable. If I said to you, there's something happening at, let's pick a company, Palantir, where the earnings growth rate looks like it's accelerating. Historically, it's 12% per annum, and we think the new vector is up at 20% per annum. What might that be? Then you've got to go and dig. And you've really got to understand, Alex, because the key in this whole thing is not taking a set of assumptions, popping them into a valuation model, right, coming out with a price, comparing it to the current price and saying, oh, this is an opportunity or it's not. We do none of the above. We don't run any valuation models on any companies, zero. And that normally shocks people. We also don't read any broker research, zero. We don't read any newspapers, sorry, zero.
I don't actually read newspapers myself either. I think the last newspaper I read must have been 10 years ago, but I do consume online publications. And you say you don't do that. So you don't consume information from online sources.
Ah, interesting way of putting it. We do consume lots of information from online sources, but it's foundational information. So mm-hmm. we use a online platform called Quartr, Quartr, and we do extensive research on transcripts. A lot of word patterning research. We look for hit rates on certain keywords in the CEO's presentation. We do a lot of cross-reference analysis, one company into another. What's the position of one company versus the competitiveness of the other? I think the central point is what we don't do is tag opinion pieces from news houses and take that as the story. What we do is we take the share price, understand the picture the market is painting, and then unravel the story. So let me give you and the listeners and readers a simple analogy. You're going to a nice sunset, you've got your iPhone, you whip your iPhone out, you take a picture, you stand in the same spot, and you take a picture a half an hour later. You've now got two pictures of the same sunset. The only thing that's changed is the light. As the share price changes, every day we come to work, every second of every day, my Bloomberg screen is reflecting a difference in price. Now, what that difference in price is, it's not a random walk, as we've been taught. It is a set of minor iterations based on the historical price, based on all new information coming in as to whether the implied growth rate of the company is still the same, going up or going down. And once that moment dawns on you, as it did in 2006, I threw all the valuation models out the window, and I developed a technique through an algorithmic process which has given me a very clear signaling process as to what the market starts to see. And all I'm looking for is a set of pictures or signals. Is it up? Is the expected earnings growth rate up or down by inference through the share price? And in fact, it's quite funny. I often hum and amuse myself sometimes with the Ben Graham value debate, because I have a standing bet out there for anybody that can show me any reference in Ben Graham to buy stocks because they are cheap. This whole myth around value investing ascribed to Ben Graham is a bit disingenuous to Ben Graham. Ben Graham didn't say buy stocks because they are cheap. He said if you can find stocks that follow the following 10 criteria, and you can find that stock at a discount to what the market in the market at a discount to what you think it's worth, then it presents you with a margin of safety. Quite a different concept to run around and buy all stocks that are cheap. And in the 1952 edition of Ben Graham, he gave us the clue, gave us a formula. The intrinsic value of a stock is equal to the historic earnings per share times, open brackets, 8.5 plus 2G, close brackets, times 4.4 over Y. The 8.5 is the price earnings multiple you would pay for a company with static earnings. There's a clue. 2G. If a company's growth rate accelerates, that little bit in the bracket, the 8.5 plus 2G, is the PE. So a company on a 20 PE is not twice as expensive as a company on a 10. It just has a slightly higher implied growth rate. And we used that formula in 1952 to back out the implied growth rate. So what we've got, we know the share price. We know how the share price is changing. The share price has an implied growth rate. As the share price changes, the implied growth rate changes. So all we do is we spend all our time analyzing implied growth instead of trying to do the forecast. It really is that simple, Alec. And once you've gone down this route for a while, you start to realize that it is, it changes your way of thinking towards the market, because you start to see the market as an incredibly complex and interconnected set of indicators. When I switch my Bloomberg on in the morning, I don't look at equity prices overnight. I look at what the U.S. 10-year Treasury has done, what the 2-year Treasury has done. I look at what the currencies have done. I look at the spreads. I look at the inflation break-evens. And by now, I'm already formulating a view as to what I see in the equity market. And then I look at the equities, and I look at equities cross-sectionally. I think so. We're not sort of focused on, we're doing financials or we're doing industrials. We look at the whole lot together and we see the picture it paints. And then we bring it all back up into the macro and say, well, what is the market reflecting? Is it net positive? Is it net negative? Is the market concerned about yield movements, currency movements? Do we have anything that's dislocating Chinese renminbi tariffs? And we just put it all together. Mm. What we end up with is a combination of stocks that give expression to how much active risk we want to take in the portfolio and how we put all those little growth vectors together into a client's portfolio like Magnus's. And so, it's pretty common sense at the end of the day.
Yeah, it sounds like it to you. I think lots of people listening to this are going to be scratching their heads and they say, thank you for the masterclass. That really was fascinating insights, and I'm sure there are going to be quite a few people using that formula from 1952. But Tony, just to ask you then, when do you, and looking at this at the Global Macro Fund portfolio, when do you start trimming? We had this problem with NVIDIA. It came into our portfolio. It was like a 5-6 bagger very quickly. When do you say, well, you know, it's sitting now at 20% of the portfolio. What are you comfortable with? And I ask that because your biggest holdings outside of the ETF are around 5%. So you and then you go down from there. And you've got some amazing performers in there. And I'll just for people who haven't been following, NVIDIA, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Meta, Netflix. Good for you on holding Netflix, staying the faith with Netflix when many of us gave up on it at one point. And those are stocks that have really done well over the last few years. So how does that balance come in?
Yeah, it's a super question. And sorry, everyone, for the masterclass, but I hope it's...
No. The masterclass is what we wanted from you. You don't go to a guy who's won the majors or won a Grand Slam and start talking to them about knitting. You ask them how they won the Grand Slam, and you've given us, so you've been very generous with those insights. I overlaying all of that, I think, is one needs a huge dose of humility, because from what I'm reading and what you were saying is that we really don't know, but the market does. So let's pay attention to these billions of inputs that are there rather than trying to impose our will on it. Yes. That's what I got from it anyway.
I'll answer your portfolio question in a sec. I think I've into my 38th, 39th year in the markets now. And the one thing I've learned about markets is respect the move. Markets are funny, Alex. In the days when I used to go up to the Halahadi, hopefully those days will come again. I'd come back to work, and after a cup of coffee in the morning, I'd go to the conference room of where I was working, and I'd put my Bloomberg on the big screen, and I would just sit quietly in the room for a morning, an entire morning, and I would look at the prices, and I would try and work out where the market is at. And only when I'd worked out and I'd said, oh, there you are, did I feel comfortable, because I'd now developed my frame of reference from 2 weeks prior. To answer your question about position sizing, we use a very impressive system developed by Dr. Reg Bust in Cape Town called IMAPS. And IMAPS for me is probably the very best system I've ever seen in the world. It risk maps a portfolio into a 360-degree circle. And I think this is often one of the overlooked things about the technical side of fund management is when you've got stocks in a portfolio, they carry certain individual risk and they carry certain risk in relation to each other, the correlation risk. And what we're looking to do with IMAPs, and we run them all the time, is we're looking to see how the stocks behave in relation to the benchmark, the MSCI World, but specifically each other. So imagine a world where you've got a big circle and you've got a line across the horizontal and the vertical. All the stocks that would be in your top right-hand corner, NVIDIA, Intuitive Surgical, Netflix, ASML, AMD, Google, Facebook, you get the picture. They're all high-growth tech stocks, and they all live in the same cluster. On the other side, in your top left-hand corner, you've got JP Morgan, Booking, Hilton, Barclays. Banks, tourism, industrial cyclicals, they live there. All the healthcare, the defensives, and some of the retailers live in the bottom right-hand corner. And then the foreigners live in the bottom left. And what we're looking for is we're looking for two things. Is there anything in our portfolio which carries too much specific risk? The very technical term is marginal contribution to tracking error risk. In simple terms, a stock shouldn't get above a certain size before you trim it back, because you don't want that much risk in the portfolio. And then we look at the clusters and we say, what stocks do we want in that part of the plot and how do they live together? So in our world, NVIDIA, Intuitive Surgical, which you would have found just if you went slightly down the list, they all live in the same space, right? So we often debate stocks relative to each other. So right at the top of the plot, you'd have XPO Logistics, Vertiv, and a stock that we used to have in our portfolio that we'd taken out, which was a cosmetics company. Now, it's odd. When in many of the investment discussions that I'm part of, I find that the debate is singular. We are discussing healthcare stocks today. United, Pfizer, Eli Lilly, Novo Nordisk. And then I sort of often throw in when I'm in the debate, well, what do you think about XPO Logistics? No, that's a logistical company. Yes, but it lives in a very similar space to Elf Beauty. So you're discussing Elf Beauty and you're discussing it compared to Eli Lilly. They live in very different parts of the risk plot. They're not health companies and beauty companies and cosmetic companies. They're very different from a risk perspective. And so I guess what we've done very differently at ThinkCell is we've thought differently about our stock selection process, a deep understanding and respect for the signaling we get from the market, a highly analytical process to interpret those market signals, and then a strong technical overlay as how to put portfolios together. And that's something that I don't find happens that often. I do get intrigued when I look at other portfolios. I look at the portfolio and it forms a picture in my head. And then I say, how did the manager put this together? And typically, if you do not have access to an awareness of something like IMAPs, there isn't really a set of tools that can help you solve that problem. So IMAPs has been very, very key in my investment journey. I think, Reg, this will take you back in time. Reg worked at Norwich and then came along through Alan Gray to Southern Life. And then he started up his own company in the 1980s. And that is known today as IMAPs, Dr. Reg Buss. And I think Ridge has made a huge contribution to fund management to the industry in terms of his technical software that's enabled us to do this. For the person at home running their portfolio, my general rule of thumb, again, very simple. The top tier of the fund that we run for Mapis, think of position sizes 4 to 7, never more. then you'd see from 2 to 4, second tier, and below 2. And we look at the portfolio to say, what's the concentration in the top tier, the second tier, the third tier? How does it risk map? And if anything's getting a bit ahead of itself, we trim back. The other simple observation, Alec, is links to gravity. Gravity and emotion. You know, when something goes stratospheric, we were Eli Lilly. We took a lot of profits. We took Eli Lilly down from 6% to 2% late last year. We did the same with NVIDIA. When stocks go parabolic, don't hang on. I remember I went to lunch with a very good friend of ours at a wine farm a few years ago when Bitcoin was all the rage, and he had his phone next to him, and he was looking at his phone like every 2 minutes. And I said to him, there's something you need to take care of. He says, it's Bitcoin. And I just looked at him and I said, if you're hanging on so tight, not a great trade. You've got to work out where your tolerances are, and also just rational expectation. If a stock is doing this sort of exponential move, it is going to come back. It cannot carry on discounting an implied rate of growth that goes to infinity. And so I've often pick up on the human side. I generally find private clients phone at the time when the stock is either near the bottom or near the top. No negative reflection on private clients. Just it's a human thing. It's getting very exciting. Have we got a lot of it? And it's getting really bad. Have we got like a lot of less of it? And that naturally tweaks my interest, because typically when I start to get those phone calls, I know we're near the selling or the buying time. And it's sort of counterintuitive. And I think one of the big things in this journey that I've learned is I'm completely unemotional towards stocks. You don't get married to a stock. If you're looking at your entry price, your exit price, and you're trying to make decisions on that, it's just bad trading strategy. I've worked with many fund managers over the years, and I've imposed on them every time the view that, guys, price on your screen is the price you got. What's your call going to be? I remember particularly on Steinhoff, we had some residual positions and the price had dropped to 20. And I looked at the team and I said, so what are you doing? They said, they're waiting. I said, what are you waiting for? The Mack truck to hit you now or later in the afternoon? And they said, no, better price. I said, price on the screen is the price you get. So I walked across the trading desk. I said to the trader, how many can we offload at $20? She said, you give it to me. I said, hit that bid. And we just stood there hitting the bid until we were exhausted hitting the bid. And we offloaded the bulk of the stock at 20. And I think it ended up subsequently at 1.50. And that was, you know, that was just an example of how the human gets terribly involved with your reference price. But I could have sold it yesterday. Well, no, you didn't sell it yesterday, so make a decision on the price. And I think, you know, if one's got a very solid framework of saying, is it going up or down? Very simple guideline. If it goes up and turns down, what's the market telling us? Is it just reassessing the growth rate? Or is there something that's fundamentally shifted? I think the obesity drugs are very interesting at the moment, because the price action on both Eli Lilly and Novo do not suggest to me that these are great wonder drugs that have just slowed down. I think there's something fundamentally wrong in the mix. If you look at Pfizer post-COVID, the share price absolutely cratered, right? So yes, they were developing Paxlovid, but it had to succeed only on the basis that COVID would persist. And the data and the statistics that were being gathered were very suggestive that this whole thesis was very problematic. So one tries to extract a lot of common sense views about a company. We don't spend a lot of time doing very detailed technical analysis on a company that no one else can do. We get a feel for the data. I served my articles under a very wise old Jewish accountant called Jack Zeller. And I often tell the story of Jack, what Jack said. And Jack would leave me on an audit, ask me what I saw, and then said to me, "Well, that's great, Tony, but when I come back in 4 weeks' time, I hope you saw what I saw." And I worked extra hard to try and figure out what Jack saw. There's a funny thing, Alex, with data. If you know, we're all in a world of AI now. You can pop something into DeepSelf or ChatGPT, gives you an answer. But there's nothing to substitute going and looking at the data and trying to get a picture of what this company's telling you. Look at the data. Platforms like Quarta are brilliant. What do they give you? They're available to everybody out there. It's a Norwegian company. These guys got tired of putting together the transcript with the SEC submissions and management presentation. That's what the website is. It gives you everything you need to know about a company. And then we just get a look and a feel. What is the tonality of the CEO? How do they put their company's updates across? Is it simple? Is it complex? Are the structures complex? I mean, you know, if anyone can explain the process Maspers thing to me, I'm all ears, because Bob did a hell of a job of messing that lot up. You know, there were so many cross-holdings and nobody knew where the capital was going. Almost impossible. And then surprise, surprise, 40, 50% discount. So there's no mystery in that. So we tend to find things that we like, that we can explain. And we did simple things the other day. Gershwin and myself, Gershwin Long, who works with me and has worked with me for many years on the portfolio, we were doing some analysis on Costco. So we decided to go and do some research work. We did online shopping in Costco. Mm-hmm. And the feel for what it would be like. What's the experience like? So you don't really need to always read the JP Morgan or the UBS report with all these complex tables and sales forecasts. You take a company, share price is going up, observation, market likes it, inference, earnings growth rate's improving, use the formula, calculate how much, and then go and spend your time understanding what the company does. And spare time just looking at how everything fits together in that company's profile, and you form a picture. Now that you've got a picture in your head, the share price change will give you an indication as to whether that picture in your head should change and what might be causing it to change. And that's where this whole process becomes super interesting.
It is super interesting talking to you as well, but I'd also like to get some insights on when you made your change into looking at global portfolios or the global stocks, because there's still many South Africans who, certainly 10 years ago, it was the JSE, and that was it. And the JSE was the focus of most South African investors. Now, we know on BizNews that there's much more interest in an NVIDIA story than a APSA story. There's much more interest in something about Netflix or Meta than even Naspers in the local market. When did that penny drop for you that, hang on, there's a much bigger world out there than the one that most South Africans are looking at?
It's a lovely question, Alex, that no one's ever asked me. It came about a little bit by accident. In some circles, it's very well known, in others, less so. I started consulting to the Sasol Pension Fund in 1984. So that's a while now. And in the early 2000s, the principal officer, incredibly competent CIO of the fund, Robbie Robinson, started a journey like everyone else did, looking for asset managers offshore. And Sasol had found a couple and engaged their services just as we were at the time. I mean, I was at Cyfrits. We'd gone out and we'd found Wellington Asset Management in Boston. It was all exciting because, you know, we all had these big new exposures. And so I suppose the journey started at Cyfrits, where I was CIO. And I had to, in 1998, deal with the global Southeast Asian crisis, myself and Sandra Gordon. And then subsequent to that, we went across and interviewed managers in New York and Boston. And for the most part, I don't think I ever sort of found somebody that resonated quite as well as Wellington Asset Management in Boston. And that tweaked my interest, but I didn't really get involved in the equity selection because we had outsourced it and we had a local business to run. And part of the Sasol success story is that the team at Sasol have managed that pension fund very, very well for a very long time under different stewardships, Robbie Robinson, Andre Scarpe, et cetera, et cetera. And it was in the early 2000s, I was sitting with Robert Robinson Sr. in his office in Sturdy Avenue, as it was then. And he looked at me and I looked at him and he said to me, "Tony, we're paying a lot of money for these external asset managers." And I said to him, "Robert, let's do it ourselves." And so Robert Robinson from Sasol and myself started to work on putting together a portfolio for the Sasol pension fund that could be managed internally. And that was about 2002. And so pretty much completely unbeknown to anybody, it was a part of my employment contract that I could do this because I had been doing it since 1984. And when I started the journey at Sasol, you may remember way back when the financial director's name was Russell Kennedy, and I had been at Southern Life, the Sasol analyst. And in those days, getting access to Sasol was very, very restricted. So this was privileged access. And anyway, I said to Russell Kennedy in 1984, "Mr. Kennedy," I said, "you've put a lot into my investment career. Is there anything that I can put back?" And he looked at me and he said, "Tony, here's a copy of the report, our fund. This is our portfolio. Tell me what you think." And I wrote about an 80-page report, Alex. And I wrote a bit on the financial markets and the macro. I still got copies of all of them. And I wrote a report on every single stock. And I came up on the next visit and presented it to it. And it's just like, "Oh, could you present this at our next quarterly meeting?" And I duly flew up and presented it. And I presented it for 20 years thereafter. I wrote a report every quarter. Eventually, it got to a fairly unwieldy 150-page odd report where I covered every single company every single quarter. And that formed the foundation of what ultimately got known as Global IP Opportunity, Global Macro. So when the opportunity presented itself in 2013 to start a global fund, I'd already been doing it for 10 years, and I had a very good working knowledge of the markets and really liked the international scene because the opportunities were just so much more vast. I think the other thing that I saw, and I got into a bit of trouble for it at the time, is I made a sort of a slightly contentious prediction in the early 2000s that South Africa would run into, I called it the first stage of structural decline. And I was asked to take the slide out of the presentation pack. It was the first quarter of 2013. And I had four diagrams. I had America, the new emerging economy, China, driven by policy dictate, commodities, the trade of the last decade, South Africa, the first stage of structural decline. And in the middle, I had a little circle and the dollar. It turned out to be quite a prophetic slide. And what I saw was capital formation diminishing in 2013. And you didn't have to extend yourself much analytically to work out as the capital structure of the economy changed, so would the growth rate. And so I reiterate today, South Africa doesn't have a growth problem at all. It has a capital and allocation problem. It's structural. And that sort of thinking really directed me towards global, because capital allocation cycles are very rich in certain parts of the world. We're seeing the resurgence now in Japan. Japan's quite exciting for us. I think once the speed wobbles are sorted out, we'll see some exciting opportunities in China again. Certainly Asia presents major opportunities, but the capital allocation in the States has been very formidable. And I think secretly, when you look at, you read an excellent book by James Ricards called Currency Wars in 2013. He absolutely nailed this dollar hegemony story. And I think while everyone was looking at the Fed for inflation guidance and for, you know, unemployment stability and things like that, the real game in town was the stronger dollar. Stronger dollar attracts lots of capital, high ROE on your investment, you know, freedom to do business. It's a competition for capital out there. And I think, sadly, the political dispensation in South Africa has missed the point of attracting that capital. It's not really about political control. It's about competing for capital. And if that problem does get solved in whatever means, South Africa's growth rate will come back quite swiftly. So that was the roundabout answer to your question. That's where it all started. It was working at the Sasol Fund for, you know, fairly substantial portfolio and having to cover all global stocks. So when we chatted in 2013 and set up the first fund, it just was an extension of 10 years worth of work.
Well, Tony Bell talks about his secret power being critical thinking. I think we've had a masterclass in that as well. It's been fascinating talking with you, Tony. It's not going to be the last one, that's for sure. Tony is the Chief Investment Officer of ThinkCell, and he manages the MyPlan portfolios. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.